Thanks, Nick. Being the product of a Jesuit education myself, I always remember a couple of things they used to tell us. One was never deny, seldom affirm, always distinguish, which many of my teachers failed to do, actually. And the second thing was persistent perversity provokes the patient pedagogue to produce particularly painful punishment, which every now and then one would have to inscribe a certain number of times for some sin or other. Well, it's a pleasure to join you here in the city of brotherly love to discuss challenges to conservatism. I'm confident that quite a lot of brotherly love would need to be expended to arrive at a universally agreeable answer to the quandaries before us. I know plenty of people, including some very smart ones, who will tell you that globalization, the subject of this panel, is one of the biggest threats that conservatism now faces. But I know others, some equally percipient, who maintain that globalization is mankind's, and therefore, a fortiori, conservatism's biggest hope. Fortunately, I do not have to adjudicate that conflict, though were I asked, I would be tempted to say that they might both be right, since what looks like a challenge seen from one point of view can appear as a tonic opportunity from another. In that sense, I suspect, globalization is a lot like its primary engine, capitalism, and can be seen as the friend or foe of conservatism, depending on what features you choose to stress. In any event, I've been asked to say a few words about a cognate subject, slightly different, but certainly cognate, namely multiculturalism, one of those vertiginous concepts, postmodern is another, that seem to expand to fill the emptiness of the heads urging its advantages. While it would be hazardous, I think, to venture a definition of multiculturalism, it is clear that the word, like the actions undertaken in its name, are deeply implicated in what Lionel Trilling called the adversary culture of the intellectuals. It is a diminishing characteristic of modern culture, Trilling wrote, to believe that the primary function of art and thought is to liberate the individual from the tyranny of his culture and to permit him to stand beyond it in an autonomy of perception and judgment. What Trilling described was a phenomenon that had its roots as far back as Romanticism and indeed the Enlightenment. But in its more recent manifestations, what had begun as a reaction to authoritarianism had developed into a suspicion of all authority, moral and intellectual, as well as political. Trilling spoke in this context of a growing disenchantment of our culture with culture itself, and of a bitter line of hostility to civilization. Multiculturalism, I submit, is one of those anti-cultural cultural manifestations that Trilling dissected. Now, Trilling was writing in the early 1960s, in other words, at the very moment when the forces of a new radicalism were poised to sweep like a tsunami through North America and Western Europe, transforming not only our educational institutions, but also the moral fabric of our entire society. Those interested in charting the course of this cultural fever will have noticed the prominent place that multiculturalism has in this lexicon of disenchantment. Moreover, the multicultural agenda has provided a kind of common cause and something of a common vocabulary for an array of disciplines and intellectual initiatives that are otherwise distinguished by often quite different interests. Still, partly because it has degenerated into something of a slogan, the term multiculturalism is apt to give rise to all manner of misunderstanding. Analogously to the distinction that Bob Royal made in the last section between secularism, a kind of ideology of the secular, and the secular realm itself, so one can distinguish, I think, between the adjective multicultural and the epithet multiculturalism. There is, first of all, the social fact that America has always been a multicultural and multi-ethnic society. Indeed, it is our country's singular political achievement to have forged a society in which vast religious, ethnic, and racial differences are subordinated to the higher unity of national identity. Hence the traditional defining image of America as a melting pot. The problem comes when this conciliatory vision of a multicultural society gives way to the ideology of multiculturalism. Here, the politics of ethnic and racial redress is allowed to trump the sustaining unity. It's happened before. In the early years of the 20th century, for example, a wave of ethnic militancy swept the country. Theodore Roosevelt was right to warn at the time, I quote, "The one absolutely certain way of bringing this nation to ruin would be to permit it to become a tangle of squabbling nationalities." A very pertinent statement to our own time, I think. It's happening again now as the ideology of multiculturalism sweeps our schools and universities and infiltrates cultural life generally. We've all become familiar with the kind of foolishness that the demand for multiculturalism and political correctness have brought to our schools and college campuses, the workplace, and government agencies. A quick and very incomplete summary includes the denunciation of Western civilization as inextricably racist, sexist, elitist, and patriarchal. It includes, too, the ideology of victimhood, which systematically subordinates educational goals to various exercises in political grievance mongering. The multicultural imperative also stands behind efforts by school and college administrators to enforce speech codes and to substitute self-esteem for academic achievement, of attempting, as G.K. Chesterton put it in another context, to change the test rather than pass the test. The recent fiasco involving those unfortunate Duke University lacrosse players provides a whole suite of examples, as in another way does the recent government-backed study in Britain, showing that more and more teachers are just simply avoiding whole subject areas, for example, the Holocaust, because they believe that discussing those subjects might offend their Muslim students. At the center of the multiculturalist ethos is the contention that all cultures are equally valuable, and therefore that preferring one culture, intellectual heritage, or moral and social order to any other is to be guilty of ethnocentrism and racism. But let's stop and ask, are all cultures equally valuable? All may have certain laudable attributes, but some have contributed vastly more to knowledge, politics, and culture than others. The journalist William Henry summed up this unpalatable truth vividly when he observed that it is scarcely the same thing to put a man on the moon as to put a bone through your nose. The thoughtless egalitarianism that lies behind the multiculturalist imperative helps to explain the current academic obsession with the notion of difference and the widespread insistence that the differences that separate us, preeminently the differences of race, class, sexuality, and ethnic heritage, must be given priority over our common humanity. This celebration of difference may sound like a prescription for tolerance and genuine pluralism, but in fact, it has fostered a kind of Orwellian situation in which diversity really means strict intellectual conformity, and tolerance is reserved exclusively for those who happen to subscribe to one's own perspective. Deviation from the multiculturalist orthodoxy on any number of issues is punished by social ostracism, mandatory consciousness raising, or even suspension or expulsion. Or if you happen to be a talk radio show host, you get fired. Like most modern tyrannies, the dictatorship of the politically correct freely uses and abuses the rhetoric of virtue in its effort to enforce conformity and silence dissent. This is part of what makes it so seductive. How gratifying, after all, it is to know that one is automatically on the side of virtue by holding a certain belief. Those of you who are students of the French Revolution will remember that remember the atrocities carried out in the name of what Robespierre called virtue and its emanation, terror. The union of moralism and radicalism, while hardly a novel marriage, is particularly destructive, I think, in institutions dedicated to intellectual inquiry and artistic exploration. Not only does it foster an atmosphere of intimidation and encourage conformity, but it also attacks the very basis for the free exchange of ideas. The aim, clearly, is not to enlighten or persuade, but rather to intimidate and to preempt criticism. This, of course, is something that our new academic mandarins refuse to acknowledge. But the truth is that what we are facing today is nothing less than the destruction of the fundamental premises that underlie our conception both of liberal education and of a liberal democratic polity. Respect for rationality and the rights of the individual, a commitment to the ideals of disinterested criticism and colorblind justice, advancement according to merit, not according to sex, race, or ethnic origin. These quintessentially Western ideas are bedrocks of our political as well as of our educational system, and they are precisely the ideas that are now under attack by bien-pensant academics intoxicated by the coercive possibilities of untethered virtue. Just how bad have things become? Alas, it is virtually impossible to overstate the case. A few examples. Richard Delgado, a law professor and proponent of the influential critical legal studies movement, neatly epitomized one aspect of the current orthodoxy when he insisted that, quote, racism and enlightenment are the same thing, end quote, and went on to argue that the concept of merit is, quote, a prominent example of the kind of racism that is evident in facially neutral laws. So in other words, the idea of merit is itself racist, according to Professor Delgado. Another law professor, the radical feminist Catherine MacKinnon, summed up a different aspect of the current situation when she declared that feminism's, quote, critique of the objective standpoint as male is a critique of science as a specifically male approach to knowledge. With it, she said, we reject male criteria for verification. So I guess 2 + 2 = 5. Of course, the assault is not undertaken solely by law professors. Michael Harris, a professor of religious studies at the University of Tennessee, put it this way. When you see the word qualifications used, remember that this is the new code word for whites. Sandra Harding, the author of The Science Question in Feminism, blithely described Isaac Newton's Principia as a rape manual. The Afrocentrist Hunter Adams assured his readers that, quote, early African writings indicate a possible understanding of quantum physics and gravitational theory. Jonathan Culler, a professor of literature at Cornell and a follower of the French deconstructionist Jacques Derrida, solemnly wrote that, quote, since no reading can escape correction, all readings are misreadings. In parts of Illinois, parents and teachers are instructed on, quote, 10 quick ways to analyze children's books for racism and sexism, and so on and so on. The important point to understand about these examples, and I could easily multiply them tenfold, as I'm sure you could, is not how extravagant they are, but on the contrary, how common they are. Such vertiginous nonsense, ranging over disciplines as various as literature, law, history, and the social sciences, now constitutes a large proportion of what is taught in schools and is pursued as scholarship in the academy. Think about that the next time you get out your checkbook to write your local college its tuition demand. The crucial thing to understand is that notwithstanding the emancipationist rhetoric that accompanies the term, multiculturalism is not about recognizing genuine cultural diversity or encouraging pluralism. It is about undermining the priority of Western liberal values in our educational system and in society at large. And it is in this sense that multiculturalism provides a convenient umbrella for the smorgasbord of radical ideologies now regnant in the academy and elsewhere. The one thing that your literary deconstructionist or your Lacanian feminist, your post-structuralist Marxist, your new historicist, your post-colonial theorist, and your devotee of what goes under the name of cultural studies, not to mention your local government bureaucrat charged with making sure that affirmative action quotas are met, the one thing that they can all agree on is that the Western humanistic tradition is a repository of ideas that are naive, repressive, or both. At the center of the multicultural imperative is the assumption that all cultural life is to be explained in political terms, preeminently in terms of gender, race, class, and ethnic origin. In other words, categories of thought that have their home in the social sciences are imported into the humanities and into the arts and are granted the status of golden explanatory keys. In good Marxist fashion, culture is denied autonomy and is reduced to being a kind of coefficient of something else, of class relations, say, or of sexual oppression or racial exploitation. Questions of quality, of artistic quality or intellectual cogency, are systematically replaced with tests for political orthodoxy, even as the whole realm of aesthetic experience is demythologized as an insidious bourgeois fiction designed to consolidate the cultural hegemony of the ruling class. In the end, these efforts to transform culture into a species of power politics rest on a more general repudiation. They rest on the contention that nothing is meaningful or valuable in itself, that all cultural phenomena, really, deep down, at bottom, are coefficients of a political power struggle. This is the fundamental message of writers like Michel Foucault, for example, whose inability to distinguish between truth and power has been greeted as a kind of divine revelation. The important thing to note, again, is not how odd, but how prevalent this idea is. I mean, those are odd ideas, but they are everywhere. They are as the air we breathe. Indeed, it is one way of articulating the core supposition, what we might call the guiding non-belief that has animated the left-wing assault on culture and on standards. It is a powerful solvent. At bottom, it is a version of nihilism and a license for sophistry. For if there is no such thing as intrinsic merit, then no judgment of quality can be anything more than a veiled political commendation or a statement of personal partisanship. Without the idea of intrinsic moral, intellectual, and artistic values, criticism and scholarship degenerate into a species of propaganda, and morality becomes little more than a cynical calculus aimed at increasing personal advantage. So it's not at all surprising that Houston Baker, a former president of the Modern Language Association, and until a few weeks ago, a tenured professor at Duke University, he's now gone on to a distinguished chair at Vanderbilt University, once said that choosing between Jacqueline Suzanne and choosing between Jacqueline Suzanne and Shakespeare was no different from choosing between a hoagie and a pizza. And he added that his career was dedicated to the abolition of those sorts of standards. And he's had a pretty good success at that, I might say. Also implicit in the politicizing mandate of multiculturalism is an attack on the idea of a common culture. The idea that, despite our many differences, we hold in common an intellectual, artistic, and moral legacy, descending largely from the Greeks and the Bible, supplemented and modified over the centuries by innumerable contributions from diverse hands and peoples. It is this legacy that has given us our science, our political institutions, and the monuments of artistic and cultural achievement that define us as a civilization. Indeed, it is this legacy, insofar as we live up to it, that preserves us from chaos and barbarism. And it is precisely this legacy that the multiculturalist wishes to dispense with. Either the multiculturalist claims that the Western tradition is really merely one heritage among many and therefore deserves no special allegiance inside the classroom or out of it, or he denies the achievements of the West altogether. Corresponding to the attack on the idea of a common culture is the multiculturalist's rejection of the idea of a common humanity. The multiculturalist rejects the idea that our identity as human beings transcends our membership in a particular race or class or sex. On the contrary, for multiculturalists, what's important is not what binds us together, but what separates us. And what separates us, be it sex or ethnicity or class or race, is used as a kind of totem to confer the coveted status of victimhood upon certain approved groups. The multiculturalists expatiate on the repressive, inequitable nature of American society ad nauseum, but it is instructive to note that people all over the world continue to flock here. They do so not because they believe the United States is perfect, but because they believe, at least with their feet, that the Western, that the Western democratic institutions that govern this society will allow them greater freedom, economic opportunity, and personal dignity than they are likely to find anywhere else in the world. The multiculturalist notwithstanding, the choice facing us today is not between a repressive Western culture and a multicultural paradise, but between culture and barbarism. Civilization is not a gift. It is an achievement, a fragile achievement that needs constantly to be shored up and defended from besiegers inside as well as out. These are facts that do not seem to penetrate the cozy and coddled purlieus of the academy, but they are part of the permanent challenge that any civilization worthy of the name must face. Behind the campaign for multiculturalism is the large question of the proper content of a liberal arts education, and finally, the question of the kind of society in which we wish to live. One way to approach that question is to return to the word diversity, the great mantra of multiculturalists. Let me begin with what may seem to many of you like an outrageous question. Is diversity a good thing? One needs only to ask the question to realize that it is a nonsensical question, for diversity, like fire, is neither good nor bad in itself. It all depends on the context. If diversity is sometimes a good thing, unanimity is also sometimes desirable. It all depends. Partisans of diversity make an elementary logical mistake. The mistake is to confuse the proposition that variety is good with the proposition that goodness is various. The fact that the latter is true does nothing to underwrite the former. The good is indeed gloriously various and diverse, but that does not mean that every expression of diversity is good. The fact that Jack loves Jill does not, alas, entail that Jill loves Jack, as Jack has found out to his sorrow. But this logical error is motivated by political animus. It is not innocent. Every school and college campus today loudly trumpets its commitment to diversity. But a closer look shows that what that really means is a slavish commitment to a left-wing social and moral agenda on issues from feminism to the curriculum to homosexuality. Diversity, in short, is a stick with which radicals beat pusillanimous liberals and confused conservatives. It is also worth noting that diversity can mean many things. It can mean a genuine intellectual variety, and I have only 2 minutes left, but it can also be little more than a synonym for affirmative action, another great Orwellian phrase that employs the rhetoric of fairness but really means discrimination on the basis of race, sex, or some other approved badge of victimhood. The multiculturalists have been strident in their praise of diversity. I will end by exercising my own right of diversity by asking you to consider the alternative advantages of commonality, or, to call it by another and older name, the advantages of prejudice. What are the advantages of prejudice? At least since John Stuart Mill, we have been encouraged to associate prejudice with ignorance and bigotry. How many teachers in primary and secondary schools, as well as colleges, regard it as their first duty to relieve their students of prejudice? But prejudice does not have to mean bigotry or ignorance. It can also mean the repository of moral, social, and intellectual wisdom represented by custom, habit, and tradition. This was something that Edmund Burke, for example, saw clearly. Prejudice, Burke wrote, renders a man's virtue his habit. Through just prejudice, his duty becomes a part of his nature. In seeking to relieve students of prejudice, many teachers also seek to relieve them of those unspoken commitments that families and churches have painstakingly sought to instill. That indeed is one reason many parents are right to be suspicious of teachers who promise to emancipate their students from prejudice. What that often means in practice is emancipating them from the moral and religious precepts they have been brought up on. It is a form of social engineering brought into the classroom and carried out by the same wretched people who think that it takes a village to educate our children. Let us grant that there is such a thing as a stultifying homogeneity, but that is not the issue in our society. There is also such a thing as groundless diversity, and that, I believe, poses a much more serious threat to our schools and our society today. In order to be meaningful, diversity must rest on a common moral, social, and intellectual culture. Without that common ground, diversity rapidly degenerates into mere tribalism. Dialogue requires not only diversity, but also devotion to shared principles. Multiculturalism threatens to rob us of those shared principles and substitute a spurious enlightenment for real educational reform. With that, I will end. Thank you.